This podcast includes information provided by the issuer and does not express the views of the interviewer. This podcast may also include forward-looking statements by the issuer that involve certain risks and uncertainties to its business. Because forward-looking statements are subject to risks and uncertainties, the issuer's actual results could differ from those indicated in this podcast. Welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you all so much for the support and for tuning in. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Bobby K. Kraft. That's B-O-B-B-Y-K-K-R-A-F-T, and you are listening to episode 34. When you get a chance, if you like what you hear, it would be awesome if you rate and review the podcast on iTunes. This really does help because I would love the feedback. For this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, I spoke with Tobias Carlisle, the founder and managing partner of Carbon Beach Asset Management, LLC, and he serves as chief investment officer. I met Tobias at a conference recently where we discussed doing an interview for the podcast. I didn't know much about Tobias at the time, but upon further research, along with his work at Carbon Beach Asset Management, he's also a published author, having written three books on topics ranging from deep value investing, activism, concentrated investing, and contrarian investing. These are all topics I want to learn more about from him for the podcast. The goal for this episode is to learn about what deep value investing means and a couple other key phrases we've heard a few times on this podcast and how they relate to microcap stock investing. Thank you again for tuning in to episode 34 of the Planet Microcap Podcast. Please enjoy my interview with Tobias Carlisle, but first, a word from our sponsor. Hey everybody, Robert Kraft here, your host on the Planet Microcap Podcast. I'd like to take this moment to invite you to join me and some of the guests you may have heard on this podcast to our annual Microcap Investor Conference, the Planet Microcap Showcase, April 26th through April 28th, 2017 at none other than the Planet Hollywood Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. The Planet Microcap Showcase will be 2.5 days of company presentations, networking opportunities, an educational workshop, and you'll get to meet privately in one-on-one meetings with company management of undiscovered and well-known microcap companies. There are a lot of surprises in store, and you're not going to want to miss it. So join us at the Planet Microcap Showcase, April 26th through April 28th at the Planet Hollywood Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. For more information, go to www.planetmicrocapshowcase.com and register now to reserve your spot. See you in Vegas. For this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, I have Tobias Carlisle on the program. He is the founder and managing partner of Carbon Beach Asset Management, LLC. Tobias, welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Robert.
It's great to have you on the program. So to start, let's get your background and then, you know, your experience investing in microcap stocks. I know you're not specifically that, but, you know, I know you have some experience in getting started on the microcap investing side. So the floor is yours, my friend.
It's my first love, so it's easy to talk about it. So I started out as an attorney in mergers and acquisitions, and I practiced in Australia and in San Francisco. As part of doing mergers and acquisitions, you do sort of activist defense, lots of transaction work, capital raising, any sort of corporate transaction that a company needs to undertake so you could sell a subsidiary, spin off a business, buy the assets of another company. And so I spent 8 years doing that, and just by virtue of the area that I was working in, I worked on everything from sort of the very smallest to the very biggest companies and across industries. And it was sort of a time when there was a lot of private equity investment. Private equity was just sort of getting started. This is in the early 2000s. It was getting restarted after kind of the dot-com. So I worked for a while in-house for a company, and it was approached by an activist who, you know, rightfully pointed out that it was, it owned a lot of assets, it was trading below the asset value, and it was doing some stuff like it was paying a dividend while at the same time it was raising capital. And his complaints were, you know, fair enough, I thought, but there wasn't anything that we were going to do otherwise because organization. And in the course of doing that, I launched a website called Greenbacked, just a little blog. And it was looking for classic Graham net nets, which are almost always micro caps. I think the biggest one I ever saw was a $2 billion market capitalization. So I just got used to pulling apart balance sheets, looking for catalysts from activists or the sort of things that made these stocks work and the sort of things that made them not work. And from that, I launched my own fund a little while ago, and I run a Carbon Beach Asset Management now, which is a which is an investor that looks sort of in slightly larger stocks just because we can't really get enough capital into the micro caps. But I love micro caps, and I still invest in them in the PA.
Mm-hmm. So one phrase that I've seen, you know, when I was doing my research on you and you know, when wanting to do the interview with you is this idea of deep value. You know, what does deep value investing mean?
So it's a great question. Benjamin Graham is the founder of value investing. He sort of codified the idea of buying at a discount to intrinsic value. So you can find where the stock's trading at $10, you think it's worth $20. He wrote Security Analysis, published in 1934, and then The Intelligent Investor, which came out in 1949. Buffett was his student, the only student famously who ever got an A from Graham. And when Buffett started investing, he was doing exactly what Graham had described as sort of net-net sub-liquidation value investing. As he sort of went along, Buffett became more of a franchise investor or sort of a growth value investor, which is he's looking for what he describes as a wonderful company at a fair price. So and Buffett is sort of associated with value investing. So I use the expression deep value to sort of show that it's not really the Berkshire Hathaway Buffett that everybody sort of knows about these days. It's not that style of value investing. It's more towards the Graham or even Buffett partnership. Buffett ran a hedge fund in the 1960s called the Buffett Partnerships, and it's really what he was doing back then, which was looking for stuff that you're looking for lots of balance sheet value, so that's your downside, undervalued assets, undervalued, you know, cash that's not getting any recognition. And then the business is often not a great business, so it's a business that it's cyclical or it looks like it's in a crisis. So you're buying these things where the business might not be sort of compounding and growing at a rapid rate, but you're trying to get them at a cyclical trough. So we're pretty confident that they're going to survive because the balance sheet value is there. We think that the business is going to pick up as whatever issue kind of dissipates, and we're trying to capture both the performance from the improvement in the business or some sort of catalyst that comes into sort of takeover or something like that. Mm-hmm. And we're also trying to capture the discount between the price and the value. Those two things together, that's kind of a deep value investing. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, it's this sort of using my old expertise, experience as an attorney, where you're looking for corporate transactions, selling assets, buying assets, the company being taken over, buying back stock, something that kind of is what I call a hard catalyst, which is some sort of corporate board level event that should create a re-rating in the price of the stock relative to its value. So that's sort of deep value investing. It's a combination of kind of deeply undervalued balance sheet value on one side and corporate transactions rather than kind of business performance.
Hmm. So it's, you know, it's interesting. I have, I did an interview a while back with Adam Epstein talking about corporate governance, and I have him in my head with what you just said, where you have your traditional value investing mixed in with potential corporate transactional stuff that might be happening in the company that, you know, you might foresee to be happening in the company. Is that kind of what you're getting at? Or is it, you know, I also have some full-time investors in my head where they're saying, you know, every microcap has a little bit of hair on it, and we like to see if maybe some of those hairs might go away sometime soon. And I don't know. Am I kind of on the right path there?
It's both. We say in our letters, we look for two things. And it's sort of two distinct categories. One of them is a special situation where there's some corporate event and we can value that. We can see, we know what the price is going to be if the event goes through. We know what the price is going to be. We know the date that it's going to go through. We can calculate a return and we can size our position accordingly. Mm. The other type is where we don't really have a future idea about it, but you're right, there's hair all over it. And we can, but some of the hair is, some of the hair can be removed by management. Some of it is just sort of looks like hair, and in a slightly different light, it's not going to look so bad. That's just that is sort of, there are stocks that just mean revert back to kind of long term value. We're just trying to pick them off when they're really cheap. In our portfolio, they never get very big because we prefer the catalyst. Where we can get deep undervaluation and the catalyst together, that will become what we call an oak. So we have sort of acorns that are smaller and oaks that are a lot bigger.
So another phrase that you've actually mentioned already, and then another phrase when I saw on your website that you bring up, and that has been mentioned on the podcast as well a couple times, is this phrase activism and contrarian. You know, what do these two terms mean, and why are they relevant to microcap investing?
Activism is an investment strategy, and often it's almost always paired with value investing, and it's always associated with deep value investing, or almost always associated with deep value investing. Basically, that's the idea that external investors who aren't on the board have an issue with the way that the company's being managed, and they feel that if they can correct that management issue or that board-level issue, they can re-rate the stock to a... they can increase the value and close the sort of discount to price. There really are two types of activism. There's the operational, where there's some problem with the business and they think they can go in and fix the business. I think that one's a really tough one to do profitably and well, and I don't think there are a lot of guys around who do it, but to the extent that there are, they tend to be involved in much bigger companies. It's just a function of, they're really often managed well from a balance sheet perspective, and that's the other style balance sheet activism, which is much more common in micro cap, small cap. Well, that's where the company's carrying too much cash because it's sold an asset and they're looking to redeploy. To the extent that the investors have any preference one way or the other, often investors prefer to have the cash returned to them or stock bought back. It's the simplest and it tends to be the most effective. Mm-hmm. Contrarian is one of those terms that everybody describes themselves as a contrarian. Everyone who's an investor says I'm the contrarian, but it has a very specific meaning in the academic finance literature. Basically, it means there are two types. This comes from a classic bit of research from 1994 called Contrarian Investing, which is written by the guys who are basically, they take the other side of the efficient market theory guys, and they say there are two types of investors. Basically, they're what they call naive extrapolation investors, and they look at a trend in the stock price or earnings or sales or whatever it might be, and they just extrapolate that trend out forever and ever. And there are these other types of investors who they call contrarians, who they assume mean reversion. So if the stock price is going down, if the earnings are going down, if the sales are going down, they don't assume that this just continues until the stock's zero. What they assume is that likely that turns around and you sort of get this mean reversion. And you can test it, and it's been tested several times in the behavioral finance literature. And it's one of those odd things that if you're looking for really high rates of growth in earnings, the place to find it is often in stocks that have the earnings have been falling over the last few years. And if you can do it quantitatively. I put a few examples of this in the book, Deep Value, where if you just did a simple screen to stocks with earnings that have been falling and you buy them cheap, you get this high rate of growth in the earnings just by virtue of the fact that they're sort of reverting back to the mean. So that's what contrarian is. It's assuming mean reversion rather than extrapolation.
I love that term, naive extrapolation.
That's the academic term. That's not my term.
No, I'm putting that on my wall, dude. That's a good one. So, Anyways, it's funny. You actually did just mention your book, Deep Value, and I wanted to ask you a question in reference to your book, because you discuss why activist investors and other contrarians battle for control of losing corporations. You know, what is the reason for this? I mean, enlighten me.
In 2012, with a guy who's a Booth PhD in finance, Wes Gray, and we just found every old bit of academic or industry research on fundamental value investment ideas. So, how do you find stocks that are safe? How do you find stocks that? How do you avoid sort of earnings manipulators and fraud and financial distress? How do you find things that are cheap? How do you find things that are good? And we went through and we built this model that sort of works a bit like a Buffett-style value investor. But one of the very first things we did at the start was to look at the magic formula, which is Joel Greenblatt's formula that comes from his book, The Little Book That Beats the Market. In that book, he says he takes this quantitative approach to Buffett, and he said there are two things that Buffett does. He looks for high returns in invested capital. That's what he calls a wonderful company. And he looks for a low price or a low valuation, which is a fair price, Buffett calls it, but let's call it a bargain price, which is sort of low operating earnings or EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes on enterprise value. And he combines those two together, and he finds that that strategy does outperform the market, even without sort of Buffett's great business analysis skills. But one of the things that we discovered when we were doing that is if you just get rid of the quality metric there, the return on invested capital, and you simply buy on the basis of operating earnings, EBIT operating earnings on enterprise value, you get much better returns. You get much better returns on a raw basis. You get much better returns on a risk-adjusted basis. It's true in the UK. It's true in Asia. It's true in Australia. It's true in the US. It's this unusual kind of idea. So we didn't really get a chance to explore it in the book, so I was sort of fascinated by that idea that the really ugly companies were the ones that ugly and cheap beat out good and cheap. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about why that would be, and then that was Deep Value was the product of that. What are the things that make these ugly cheap companies outperform good cheap companies? So I think there are two. Basically, it's external management teams see that the company's undervalued, and there's an opportunity for them to come in and rectify the situation and capture both that improvement in fundamentals and the discount to the price. And the other thing is that there is just this mean reversion. There's this, the internal managers themselves probably don't just sit there on their hands. They try to sort of fix the problem. Often it's industry specific, so you'll see, you know, so we watched recently, energy had this monster run. There was lots of drilling being done in the shale for coal seam gas in the US, and it sort of energy was very, very expensive. So there's an enormous amount of investment that goes into it. And then when the oil price really falls, all of that investment sort of is still there, but new investment disappears. The price of those stocks drops precipitously. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, you have this entire industry that's filled with companies that are sort of struggling for liquidity, but they do have some asset value. So that would be a good opportunity to go through. You'll see a lot of activism. You'll see cheap stocks that you could get set in. And so that's a good example of sort of just that mean reversion, activism, deep value. And the book just goes through all the reasons why the function of mean reversion and the sort of behavior of activists and how that all works together to push up deep value, deeply undervalued stocks.
So Tobias, just a follow-up question to that. In your opinion, really separates an ugly but cheap versus just a bad business?
I think it's balance sheet liquidity. Yeah. That's one thing that it gives you enough runway to fix the problem. The two things that are fatal to businesses are too much debt. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of a longer-term thing. That's sort of a tapeworm that eats all of your value. And the other thing is just, you know, no liquidity, no sort of cash on the balance sheet. More than anything else, the lack of cash on the balance sheet, the lack of liquidity, or the lack of free cash flow from the operations just means that they can't survive long enough. And most industries cycle many businesses cycle, most businesses cycle. It's a very small percentage of businesses that don't cycle. And the very small percentage, it's about 4% of the sort of Buffett-style value stocks. That they never get really, really cheap. But if you watch them closely enough, you can get them. Just what Buffett and those sort of guys are doing. They're trying to get them when they just sort of drift down a little bit, and they can get a sort of low to high teens return on them over a long period of time. Deep value guys are waiting for these things to really stumble, to almost trip over, because it looks like the business might be done. But you can see there's enough balance sheet liquidity there that they can survive. Maybe they are free cash flowing a little bit. Either the management is prepared to do something about it, or there's an external management team that could do something about it. Mm-hmm. The best way, I think, to determine whether management is worthwhile, management is good or not, it's just to look at the buybacks in a company. So the buybacks tell you a lot. They tell you that they do have free cash flow, mm-hmm. which is rather than just being printed in the cash flow statement, it really is real free cash flow that they can use. Mm-hmm. It tells you that the stock is probably undervalued, although for many companies, that's not true, that most buybacks occur in very overvalued companies. But it also tells you that management is interested in capturing some of that undervaluation. So when I find something that's deeply undervalued with free cash flow, with management doing something about it, I think that's a pretty good bet in a portfolio over a period of time.
Yeah, that you actually just hit on something I wanted to ask is, you know, when as a deep value investor, it seems like there's a couple different ways you can go about it when you're assessing management. On one hand, you can, you know, you do your due diligence and, you know, you find out that the management is doing something about the situation they're in because, you know, their industry has gotten to a down point in the valley, so to speak, in their cycle. Or you assess that management kind of just is a lame duck and there's external management potentially that's going to come in that can, you know, solve some of these issues. Am I right on that assessment?
That's it. Basically, management, I think it's very difficult to assess the quality of management. There are good managements out there, there's no question, but often it's a good business and it's hard to work out whether they're good managers or it's a really good business. But I don't really spend a lot of time thinking about it because they're rarely in my screens. More often, the business looks like it's in a little bit of trouble. Mm-hmm. And you either... is it management's fault or is it just the industry that they're in? Often it's the industry, and you have to work out, have these guys foreseen the possibility that this business, this industry could get into a trough? Have they kind of saved up a little bit of money there? Do they have a little bit of liquidity? Are they prepared to buy out their assets, pay down debt, buy back some stock? If they are, then you've got, that's a good management team. There are very few around. They tend to be sort of owner managers who've been around for a long time. I like finding teams like that, and we invest in a lot of those businesses when they stumble.
So you touched again. You touched on a few of the things I'm about to ask in my next question, but to kind of sum up, you know, what are some of the deep value investment principles that Carbon Beach employs?
The first one is assuming that it's undervalued. Let's assume that we've got a list of stocks that are deeply undervalued that we're watching really closely. Cash-rich balance sheet has to have some liquidity on the balance sheet. The business is still, it doesn't have to be a great business, but it's still kind of plugging along. So you're not paying a great deal for that bad. You're paying less than that bad business is worth at the very trough, hoping that it has enough liquidity that it can survive. And when it survives, at some stage, you'll sell it to somebody who can look at 5 years of good growth and think maybe that business has turned the corner. I think that often those businesses are then getting a little bit closer to the top of their cycle. And so that's the sort of time when we're trying to sell out.
And real quick, I actually wanted to follow up on one term that you just said. You know, for those who don't know, what do you mean by liquidity on the balance sheet?
So liquidity is cash for the most part. It's cash or equivalents that less often some sort of current asset that can be rapidly turned into cash. Mm-hmm. It's making sure that basically that they're not insolvent, they can meet their debts as and when they fall due. Mm-hmm. They've got cash in the business, they've got cash flow. It's to make sure that they can survive. That's the first thing they're looking at. Can this business survive whatever kind of trial or tribulation it's going through? Currently, if we think it can survive, then our next stage is to sort of think, you know, what can it do over a period of 2, 3, 5 years?
So, okay, with your investment principles, that philosophy in mind, that Carbon Beach employs, you know, what is then the investment process? You know, what is the decision that you then make, like, okay, time to take a position? And then conversely, when you decide to sell?
We start with screens. My favorite screen is one called the Acquirer's Multiple, which is just it's the approach that a private equity, a buyout shop or an activist might use, looking for something that's undervalued, that's stumbled, and all of that's sort of built into the screen. Then we go through that. Can this thing survive? Yes, it probably can survive. Is management sort of not going to issue so much stock, or are we not going to get diluted out in this process of sort of surviving over 2 or 3 or 5 years? If we can, so if we get to the point where we're going to make an investment, we look at the equity, we look at the options, we'll look for any long-term options, like we'll look at the leaps. We'll see how to shape our investment in such a way that it creates the best chance of that asymmetric opportunity. So something that's asymmetric has a limited downside and a much, much bigger upside. And the reason we would do that, so we might look at something where we think this thing's deeply, deeply undervalued, but there's a chance that this thing goes to zero. But it's so undervalued that it's worth putting a position on. In that instance, we might be looking for the leaps, the long-term call options, basically. So that's something that the strike is more than 12 months away, expires more than 12 months away. So we're looking at the 2018 or 2019. And the reason we might do that, so if you're going to put you've got a $100 portfolio, you want to put $10 into this stock, but if it goes to zero, you lose the whole $10. So you might be able to find a leap for a dollar, and then if the stock goes from $10 to $20 or $30 or $50, your $1 leap probably goes up sort of 15 or 30 or 40 times, something like that. But if it goes to zero, then your $1 leap is already thrown away. So on a $10 stock, you'd be prepared to take a 10% loss. So that's the way we think about sizing those. So that's the last step of the process. How do we actually put this position on? Sometimes we also sell options. So we might, you know, if it's a $10 stock, we can see an $8.50 strike. We can sell a put in that instance. So a put sale is, a put is you're giving somebody else, if you sell the put, you're giving somebody else the right to sell that stock to you at a fixed price, at a fixed date in the future. So if you sell the put, your downside looks like equity downside. You might have to buy this stock if it goes below a particular price. If you're a deep value guy like us and you've done the work and you like the balance sheet and you don't mind the downside, if it's a $10 stock and it's got an $8.50 strike or a $7.50 strike and you can sell that option for a few dollars, then you might be able to reduce your buy price, your sort of effective buy price even further. In the event that you don't get struck, you've just collected the premium. In the event that you do, you sort of built in a cheaper price. So that's what we look at. We look at the equity, then we look at how much volatility there is in the options, and that might guide us to whether we're selling puts or buying calls. And the process is reversed on the other side. When we think it's getting close to value, we might just sell the equity. We might sell some calls, which is sort of to say, if the price gets to this point, then we'll have sold at this price plus we'll have pocketed some premium. But we're not too concerned about buying or selling at this price. We do that a lot. So if we think there's some dead time in the stock, but there is an event coming up in the future, it's sort of 2 or 3 months away, we might sell some puts. So we're just collecting the volatility. If it trades down, we've bought some more. If it doesn't, we've just sort of reduced our buy price. Mm-hmm.
And then when do you consider, you know, let's say you were taking more of a long-term position in a deal, and obviously there's two sides of this coin. There's obviously the side where, you know, you're selling because, you know, it hit my multiple that I wanted it to hit, that I did the numbers. But, you know, what is your strategy when it comes to selling? You know, I know I know you just mentioned, you know, the, when you're in your starting position and mentioning selling puts and that, but you know, at what point do you then decide, okay, it's time to liquidate this position?
We get a pretty good idea what we think it's worth. Mm-hmm. And what we will typically do is as it approaches that valuation, we're already selling some of the position down. So it might be quite a bit. It could be like a 10 or 15% position at inception. And if it moves up quickly and we don't think the underlying value has changed at all, that's sort of approaching our value, it makes sense to reduce the size of that position. And the reason that you do that is that the risk-reward has changed. The risk-reward when it's very wide is very good. And the risk-reward when it's when the spread is tight becomes less interesting. And so now you've got a much, much bigger position that has a much worse risk-reward ratio. And so we'd have sold down quite a lot. Then by the time it's sort of at our valuation, we might sell it out. We do have some stocks that they're just sort of congenitally undervalued, even though they're quite good stocks, and they compound up over time. So we check on a quarterly basis, and we often find book values up, businesses a little bit better. So we shift up our valuation. We might just stay in the stock and not sort of do anything with it and just let it grow along with the portfolio.
Okay, so this is one of my favorite questions that I ask, and I hope you've drawn up some of your old memories in investing. So, you know, what experience can you draw upon that helps shape this whole investing philosophy that you're putting forth out there?
Being an attorney is an unusual sort of skill set, especially I was an attorney for so long before I transitioned across. So I think whenever I think about the advantage that I might have over some other investor analyzing a stock, to the extent that I have an advantage, it's never going to be in assessing a really good business. I'm not going to, you know, Buffett has this great skill where he can sort of look at how great a business is and it's going to compound up and it's going to keep on going. And lots of guys can sort of find these stocks that will be very well-known, famous brands in the future. And they've either got a consulting background or they're just very good at doing it naturally. That's never going to be the skill that I have. The skill, to the extent that we have any additional skill, it's sort of, to the extent that I have any additional skill, it's always going to be in analyzing the transaction, getting a feel for sort of whether the transaction goes through or not, you know, what their motivation might be for doing something, and sort of understanding. I've seen that process, you know, countless times at a board level where they're making that decision, and I know how hard it is to sort of change things around and how risk averse most boards are. And so I draw a lot on that. I've done a lot of, when I was working in the activist fund, I've seen the way boards and companies react to activism. And I think the thing that most, it's a little bit like litigation. Most people assume that when they rattle the saber that the other side just sort of falls over with their legs in the air and waves the white flag and surrender. And what happens, what tends to happen is the reverse. People get into their bunker and get ready for a fight. So I have some views on activism that might be a little bit kind of different to a lot of other views out there. I much prefer the sort of behind the scenes, engaged, quieter. I think that's more type of activism. I think that's more effective than the very loud, out front activism. Although, again, it does depend on who the activist is. If they're good at that style, then you know you got to give them credit for that. So that's sort of it's that sort of. That sort of legal and activist sort of background that I draw on. Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, that's interesting you bring that up. I hadn't really thought about it, that, because my impression of activist investing and is mostly that, like, you know, it's a known guy, known activist. He got in the company and everyone's like, oh, he or she just got in the company. Oh my gosh. Uh-oh, here we go. Like, what are they doing? You know, but it's interesting to hear that there's also that more behind the scenes type activism too that takes place, you know. So what is that main difference then? You know, is it like you said, is it just a difference of way in which you do it, or which do you think tends to be more successful?
Behind the scenes is much, much more successful, in my opinion. Which is, you know, it's not any. I'm just trying to think what the word is. That behind the scenes activism is still kind of pretty tough activism. Like they're still sort of saying, we've got a big enough shareholding to compel you guys to do some things. We would like to be on the board. We think that you're doing the wrong thing. But I think you have to look at the motivation of the activists or what they're seeking to achieve. If they're seeking to achieve something with the business, I often find that less interesting because I think I know how hard that is to, I know how hard it is to have a success in that regard. Often the guys running the business are the guys who know the most about the business. It's difficult for external guys to understand intrinsically what the business needs. If it's a balance sheet question, I think anybody can look at the balance sheet. And often it's the guys who are internal, who have a background in engineering or something else, and they've been so focused on running the business, they've lost sight a little bit of what should be done with the balance sheet. And they, their ideas are that you can keep on investing in this business and you can grow this business, but if you look at the capital allocation record, it's not great. And you might say, well, a better use of your capital at this stage might be to buy back some of your stock or to pay it out because you're not sort of getting enough of a return on it in your business to justify you holding it. So I'd like that sort of quiet behind the scenes balance sheet activism to the extent that I can find it. There's not a great deal of it about. I often follow guys into businesses where they're doing that sort of stuff.
So what also is your advice for new microcap investors? How should they approach looking at, you know, as a new investor looking at the microcap space?
The best thing that I ever did, and I'm not saying that this is what everybody should do, I'm just saying this is the best thing that I ever did, it was to go and read the security analysis chapters on net current asset value investment, sub-liquidation value investment, and then to go and find the websites that, where they undertook these valuations and to learn to do them myself, because I think the one thing that most people do is they look at the business of a company and they assume that that's sort of all there is to it. The business is going really well, so this is a good company. The business is going really badly, so this is a bad company. The business and the company are two entirely distinct things. So as an attorney, I often think about that. The business is sort of what they're doing to generate income. The company owns the assets. It employs everybody. It holds the cash in the balance sheet. So if you think in those terms, you start thinking about, well, what assets does it own? What does the balance sheet look like? And if you pull apart the balance sheet, you'll often find that there are companies that are trading at a discount to cash. They're trading at a discount to their current assets. There's not much that can go wrong. Obviously, they've often got terrible businesses. So you've got to get comfortable investing in these businesses. But there's lots of research to show that if you're buying at a big discount to current asset value, or cash on the balance sheet, that there's some sort of good little bump in the road in the future where you can get out of these things and you can make pretty good money. And there's not a lot of guys hunting in them because they're so small. You can get kind of quite good at it pretty quickly because it's simple. They're easy to calculate. The returns are pretty good, and it starts you thinking in that process of looking at the balance sheet and distinguishing the business and the company, which is the stock. So I think about the company is sort of all the stock put together is the company. The business is this sort of distinct creature from it. And they can sell businesses and buy businesses, but the company is the thing that you hold. So I think getting comfortable with balance sheets, then you become, you sort of have a more jaundiced eye when you're looking at the earnings. You look at that, you realize that the cash flow is really the most important thing. And I think that sort of pretty quickly you can push yourself into a small group of investors who have a pretty good idea what's going on with the stock, and you'll, without that competition, you get some good returns.
So Tobias, as we wrap up here, you know, where can my audience go and find more information about you and Carbon Beach Asset Management and Greenbacked?
So I've got a few websites. One of them is Greenbacked. It's Greenbacked. So there's no ED there, .com. And that's a site that was very active on years and years ago, but less so now. The site that you can screen for these stocks that are undervalued on a private equity basis is the Acquirers Multiple. So that's just acquirersmultiple.com. And then the asset management business is carbonbeacham.com. And you can sign up to receive our letters. We write a quarterly letter. We manage accounts. We manage bigger accounts. the end of this year.
Well, Tobias, thank you so much for joining me on the program. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Robert. Great questions.
No, thank you. Great answers. Thank you. Thank you all for tuning in to the Planet Microcap podcast, and thank you, Tobias, again for coming on to the program. You can access the podcast by going on to stocknewsnow.com under podcast, go to podbean.com and search Planet Microcap podcast, or on iTunes and search Planet Microcap podcast. Stay tuned for the next Planet Microcap podcast, where we'll have our next guest to discuss all things microcap. If you have any questions or comments about the podcast, please send an email to info@stocknewsnow.com. I'd love to hear from all of you. This podcast has been brought to you by SNN Incorporated, publishers of StockNewsNow.com, the official microcap news source, and the Microcap Review magazine. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you again for joining me on the Planet Microcap podcast. Have a very happy new year, everyone.